Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here, of course, with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you recently had a piece at National Review describing four major threats to American security, three of them state-based, one of them from terrorists. Let's start with Iran, because we haven't had a chance to talk about that since the nuclear deal was struck. You say in your piece, quoting you here, Iran in the short term, even though the weakest of these three anti-American autocracies, the other two in this piece are Russia and China, is also the most dangerous, end quote. Those words were written before the deal was struck in Vienna. Are they any weaker or any less dangerous now as a result of that agreement?
Well, they're much more dangerous and much stronger because of a number of reasons. They don't have to worry about on-site inspections anywhere, anytime. It's going to be very hard to ever get a kickback sanction if they violate, because China and Russia are not going to play ball with us anymore, especially because we've kind of embarrassed them. So they're not going to be involved. And there's not going to be a very viable domestic opposition, the sort of that showed up a million people strong in the streets in 2009 to protest the crooked elections. All of a sudden, they're contending with the publicity inside Iran that says, we humbled the great Satan. We get to keep our nuclear. We will have a nuclear bomb. We have $150 billion we got. We have 30 million barrels of oil in storage that's going to go on the market. So it's a win-win for the theocracy. It's sort of like General Halder, who was Germany's chief of staff when the Allies caved in the Anschluss and in Czechoslovakia. He writes, you know, there's no hope now of stopping Hitler. If they just had stood up to him, we would have had some leverage against him, but there's not going to be any depth. And then look at the Allies. What is Egypt and Jordan and Israel going to do? I mean, in the case of Jordan and Egypt and the Gulf monarchies, I suppose they're going to say, if you give your enemies such a deal, give us the same thing. And if you think Iran won't cheat, then we won't cheat. But if you think they will cheat, we'll cheat. We just want the same thing you give your enemies. And what are the Eastern Europeans are going to say, or what's Israel going to say when they're going to be in missile range with Russian missiles and nuclear devices, theoretically not too long from now, because they're not going to stop it. There's no reason. The problem with the deal is, why does Iran want nuclear enrichment? They have 200 years supply of natural gas. We know why they do. And finally, what are you going to tell Greece? You're going to say, well, if you just had some centrifuges, we would have given you terms. The Germans would have been really nice to you if you had started enriching uranium. Maybe you can enrich your debt or something so they can work out a program for you. But we're much harder on our NATO and EU allies than we are on our enemies. So there's nothing good about it. And I think even John Kerry will admit that none of the things that they said just a year ago that were requisites for the deal, whether it's anytime, anywhere, sanctions, inspections, or immediate sanctions if they violate it, or don't lift the sanctions until they comply, that's out the window. And this is where we haven't even broached the topic of all of these rumors of these side agreements about sanctions and even protecting the existing so-called non-military aspects of enrichment from damage, as if we're the guarantor now of what, cyber war from Israel against Iran. It doesn't make any sense. John Kerry will get his Nobel Prize and he'll be very happy at the end of the year, but in 5 years he's going to be known as Neville Chamberlain. He really is.
Victor, when you talk to people on the right, the reaction to this Iran deal is, for the most part, almost a lack of comprehension. It's not just that they disagree with the Obama administration's rationale. It's that they can't even particularly articulate it. What do you suppose the underlying psychology is here? What is the president telling himself about why this is a worthwhile deal?
Well, ostensibly, people say the following, that after the Obamacare fiasco, the Libya fiasco, the Iraq fiasco, the ISIS fiasco, the Mubarak-Muslim Brotherhood fiasco, the reset fiasco, he wants a foreign policy legacy, so that he wants to say to people, I was the one that brought Iran out of the cold, so to speak. But that's a very generous interpretation. I think it's more likely that as in the case of our quote-unquote special relationship with Turkey, Erdogan, and our quote-unquote new relationship with Cuba, and what reset was supposed to be like, Obama really feels that he's sort of the doppelganger to Donald Trump, that just as Donald Trump says he can cut a deal with anybody, Obama feels that any autocratic would-be revolutionary who feels genuine and authentic, Obama will match him and meet with him and win him over. And why would he want to do that? Because I think Obama has a different vision of the post-war order than most Americans. He doesn't see it as a success. He doesn't see that it prevented World War III. He doesn't see that the Cold War was won by us. He doesn't see that globalization, travel, communications, and commerce are all as a result of the American post-war order. He sees it sort of like America abroad is the 1% at home. It's very unfair. We've demonized Iran. I think he used the word they could be a legitimate power in the Middle East, and he feels it's his duty to sort of level the playing field, contextualize its violence and extremism, and in a more equivalent fashion, make it sort of like Israel. And it seems almost crazy to think anybody could be so stupid or naive, but there's no other way to explain it. He really does believe that Iran will be a positive force in the Middle East.
You also talk about Russia in this piece and the fact that the Obama administration seems to have misunderstood Vladimir Putin from the get-go. And I want you to explain that, but also to offer your diagnosis of the elephant in the room where Putin's concerned. Can he break NATO? How likely is it, in your estimation, that we see more Russian aggression in the near to midterm that seeks to see whether he can call the West's bluff in Eastern Europe?
I'm really worried about Putin and our foreign policy stable of experts and military strategists, etc., because they seem to be ignorant of history. They think, well, Putin's not stupid. The United States has three times the conventional and twice the military capability in the nuclear strategic sphere, so he wouldn't do anything stupid. And Russia is an aging, dwindling population, and it's in chaotic. It's a chaotic mess. So obviously, he's not going to take on another liability as he is bogged down in eastern Ukraine. I think there's no historical support that dictators or autocrats are rational. Hitler, when he went into France, the Mark I tank was a joke. The Mark II tank was a joke. British Spitfire production was large; it was greater than ME-109 production. By any fair measure, Blitzkrieg was just kind of a patched-together operation against neighbors that happened to be within good supply distance of Germany, but it was nobody in their right mind thought it was very overwhelming, but he did, and he was very right to think it was, because he looked at, as he said, of Chamberlain and Daliadier, he said, "I saw them at Munich, they're worms." And so Putin says to us, wow, I went into Georgia, Ossetia, Crimea, Ukraine. They think I won't go into Estonia because it's a NATO member. I'm going to go into Estonia because it's a NATO member, because it's my pleasure. I want to. And it's not going to cost him very much. We know the prescription, a bunch of 40% of Estonia within a day's drive of St. Petersburg are being persecuted, paramilitary agitation, a need for Russian mercenaries to go in and stabilize the situation, and then you undermine the government. And I don't think he thinks that Germany or France are going to do anything. He doesn't think Obama's going to do anything. And then he thinks, wow, there's such a thing called Article 5 of the NATO alliance. They didn't invoke it, did they? So is there a NATO alliance anymore? That's a win-win situation for him, as I see it. And Putin doesn't have a graph on his desk that says, wow, tanks, planes, strategic weapons, submarines, carriers, I don't stack up to the United States. He says, there's me and there's Barack Obama. And he can have all the assets in the world, but if he's not going to use them, or he's not going to threaten to use them, or I don't believe that if he does threaten me with them, they're serious, then the ledger on his side is much greater, because he calls it willpower and iron will. And he feels he's a Peter the Great, he's a Joseph Stalin, etc. And that's what's scary about him. he'll do something irrational because he is weak, and he is weaker than we are, but he doesn't think he is. And so that's how wars start, when there's this miscalculation, and the correction and the reality and the sobriety is war. But that's a terrible way to bring back sanity.
The third state that you mentioned here is China, which seems by your description to be perhaps – maybe subtle isn't the right word, but the most cunning, at least, of the three, and how it's attempting to cultivate power. You write here, quoting you, China assumes that its growing military capabilities, its new sandcastle bases in the critical sea lanes of the South China Sea, and its intrusions into the territorial waters and airspace of Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and the Philippines – are slowly redrawing the Pacific map, close quote. So, Victor, what happened here? The big strategic foreign policy shift of the Obama administration was supposed to be the pivot to Asia, something that, as it was articulated, seemed to have as one of its core objectives the goal of keeping China from stretching its legs in precisely this fashion. How did we get from there to here?
Because we have these democratic, very successful tiger economies, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, and to a lesser extent, the Philippines, and certainly Australia. And these areas all depend on the American security guarantee, both conventional and strategic. So you got a president comes along and says, oh, we want to deploy down to 1,500 deployable nuclear weapons, and then they leak that we'd like to get down to 500 because they're so sophisticated that they don't believe that a Japanese or a South Korean or Taiwan general says to himself, 50 of those were mine, 80 of them were to secure my country, 58 were for us, because they think that's too Neanderthal. But that's exactly what they think, because I've talked to people like that, and they feel that they're no longer in the American security umbrella. They believe that we're going tit for tat with Putin, reducing weapons while China's getting stronger, both nuclearly and conventionally. And they think, wow, United States has all of these commitments. China doesn't. Soviet Union doesn't. United States needs an overwhelming military because it's protecting us. Meanwhile, China's flying in their airspace or building these crazy sand islands on the sea lanes where 25% of the world's commerce goes. And they're saying basically to our allies, hey, you guys, you saw what Obama did in Syria with the red line. You saw what he did with Putin, the step over line. You saw what he did with Iran, the deadline. Look, he won't defend you. You should either join us and be part of the new co-prosperity sphere, or you can oppose us. And you know what's going to happen if you oppose us? And then they're thinking, wow, is the United States going to protect us? Should we join the Chinese, or should we go nuclear ourselves? Because we do have a nuclear capability. And they're worried about North Korea. They're worried about China. They're worried about Russia. And I think we're going to end up with combining our interests this morning. If you look at the Middle East and Japan, we haven't had a quote-unquote friendly power go nuclear except for Israel since France did. They've all been so-called belligerents, China, India, Pakistan, North Korea. I think we're going to see the legacy of the Obama administration is that we're going to see powers like Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Japan or Taiwan or South Korea develop some type of nuclear capability, either on the Iranian acquisition model or just go do it themselves. Because if I was a Japanese military officer, a strategic planner, and I looked at China and what they say in China about Japan and what they do to Japanese borders, and then I look at the United States now, I wouldn't count on anybody. I think we're creating a lot of Israels that can't count on anybody but themselves.
Fourth and final factor here in your piece, Victor, unsurprisingly, ISIS. There's a school of thought out there. I've actually heard several conservatives take this position, that ISIS is so focused on conquest in the Middle East, so monomaniacal about establishing and expanding the caliphate that, you know, maybe this is all cabined to the Middle East. Maybe it just all plays out as a Sunni-Shia fight, that we shouldn't be all that concerned about them launching an attack on the United States. Are you that sanguine about that question?
Not really, because they're very brilliant in whom they appeal. They look at a westernized Arab expatriate Sunni community, and they feel that you're bored, you're unemployed, but you have a level of affluence and yet you're soulless. And we have a mechanism to reach you in the internet, globalization, et cetera, et cetera. And so we have these lone wolves in the United States, or ISIS inspired. We have them in Britain. We have them in France. And that's a little bit more than a nuisance, because some of them could, if they got coordinated, could do a lot more damage than just shoot people in Texas or shoot people in Tennessee or whatever, wherever they do it. So that's a real worry. And the second thing is the Western pretenses of morality, as we saw with Milosevic, are always that we're not going to stand by why there's another Rwanda, or we're not going to stand by a Srebrenica. So when they start destroying a UN cultural site, like, you know, they can go into Palmyra or they can go into any of these places and desecrate, destroy antiquities as they did in Iraq, or they can behead people on video, or they can burn them alive, or they can drown them, or they can do all these horrific things to them. What they do is each time they do it and publicize it, they remind the world that the West is a little bit more self-absorbed, decadent, impotent. And collectively, individually for now, it doesn't matter. But in the long run, they're weakening the perception of the West abroad. And inside, they're basically telling the Westerners themselves. Westerners are saying to themselves, wow, we don't really believe in anything. We don't want to make any sacrifices. Those people are just hopeless. They're barbaric. They're pre-modern. They're Neanderthal. They're troglodyte. And that's okay, because it's a very sympathetic point of view. But ultimately, you got to do something if you're a civilized, caring, compassionate culture. And that's what comparing big evil things to less big evil things. Hitler, that's what he did all during the 30s. And everybody in the United States said, you know what? Kristallnacht was bad. I don't approve of it. Gosh, in Dachau, that's terrible. They killed 100,000 of their own citizens that were disabled. We hear that after they went into Poland, the Jews are disappearing. But you know what? That's just what those people do in Europe. That's just what they do in Eastern Europe. We can't get involved. They killed 6 million people that could have been stopped. So I take them seriously. I take them seriously at what they say. I take seriously what they do. They're in a very volatile period where Iran is going nuclear. Pakistan has nuclear bombs. 30% of the world's oil still comes out of the Middle East. So it's something we should be worried about. And it doesn't do any good to make fun of them as JVs, or the way we made fun of Putin as, I think he called it, macho shtick. So the president has a bad habit of saying, you know, these people are illogical, they're irrational, they're JVs, but they don't see themselves as that way. And just because they don't have sophisticated weapons and the ability to you know, airlift a division doesn't mean they're not dangerous and should be dealt with.
So final question, tie all these threads together for us. You've got Iran, Russia, China, ISIS. I think it's fair to assume that we're not going to see any big changes coming from the Obama administration in its remaining 18 months or so. So for the next president, what are the imperatives in dealing with these threats, both in terms of policies and in terms of resources?
Well, what usually happens in cases of a chronic appeasement or indifference, the person who comes into office, you know, whether it's the coalition under Demosthenes the statesman or it's the Churchillian government on May 10th, 1940, then they're seen as very radical, or they're seen as, wow, they're extremism, because they're extreme because there's a new normalcy. So somebody's going to have to come in and say, you know what? Peace is not the natural order of things. Chaos is. And all of these things have to be dealt with. But boy, I feel sorry for the next president, Democrat or Republican, because they're going to have to say to Putin, you're not going to go into Estonia. Or they're going to have to say to Iran, you're not going to enrich uranium the way you thought you were. Or they're going to have to say to ISIS, we're going to have to really bomb you guys and put you in your place. And they're going to have to say to China, you know, you're not going to bully Japanese anymore because we have a lot more power than you. And we're going to use it to show you that. But to do that will be sort of like Reagan. If you remember, he came in 82, 83, came in 81. But by 82 or 83, they were having special TV movies that, you know, the day after Reagan was going to blow us up, nuclear winter. I think that was the term we used, nuclear winter. And it wasn't until 85 and 86 he was Grandpa Reagan that was winning the Cold War. And so that's the danger. And then there's one last, and just to finish, it's not clear to me that we're going to make the 17 months without some kind of major disturbance, because all of these bad actors you've mentioned, they're like gamblers that have been winning, and they think, wow, I can get a big score and then take my chips and leave. So if you're China, it's sort of like, let me, you know, redirect my attention to Taiwan, or explain to the Japanese this is the new reality. Or if it's ISIS, maybe I should try to take Baghdad. Or if it's Iran, you know, maybe I can get Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Lebanon in line. Or maybe if it's Russia, Estonia. And when are we ever going to get, I'm thinking what they're imagining, when are we ever going to get a president like Obama again? Remember, Jimmy Carter was going out of office. He was behind in the polls at the end of summer of 1980, but people had the impression that it was too good to be true if you were abroad. So the Chinese went into Vietnam, the Russians went into Afghanistan, and they took hostages. They got rid of the Shah. They declared a theocracy in Iran. There were all of a sudden, Central America was, man, it was communist uprising after communist uprising, because they thought, we better act now before this nut Reagan comes in. And that's what they did. So it's going to be a very dangerous, interesting, but dangerous time in the next year and a half.
All right. That's all the time that we have for today. Join us next week for the next installment of the Classicist Podcast. And in the meantime, stop by hoover.org, where you can read all of Professor Hansen's commentary. We'll see you back here soon. For Victor Davis Hansen and the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.